If you prayed, "Lord, bless me," what would the content of an answer to that prayer look like? So if you're asking for God's blessing and He answers it, what do you get? If you were to pray, "Lord, make me more like Jesus," is that a different question with different content? Would we agree that being conformed to the image of Christ, for instance, being more like God, is a blessing? Do we believe that these two requests are the same? Lord, bless me, and Lord, make me more like Jesus. Or do we have a different hope in the one request, blessing, and a certain sort of fear that comes with the question of the request of being conformed to the image of Christ? I mean, play a game this week. As you are perusing social media, I'm not commanding you to peruse social media, but if you are, or if you are online in any form, or even passing by local churches that have any sort of signage out front, consider the theology that you see, and take stock of what you are hearing. I decided in preparing for the sermon, I would put in the hashtag Jesus and just write the two first theological statements that were made with that hashtag. The first was this. It was a comic, and in the comic, it was Jesus down on one knee, and he had a big teddy bear behind his back, and in front of him was a child with a smaller teddy bear in their hand with the caption, "Trust me. I have something better for you." And of course, his hand outstretched implied that he was going to take away the little teddy bear, but not to fear, because there was a teddy bear twice as big hidden behind his back, ready to be given once someone was willing to give up the smaller one. A few things are implied there, pretty obviously. One is that bigger is better. And something that may be pedantic or maybe too obvious to state, but not only is bigger better, better is better. Isn't that true? Isn't that what we all want, is something better? The second theological statement that was made was simply a caption in a picture that read this: imagine doubting yourself, I mean, if you can imagine it, but imagine doubting yourself, and then boom, God shows you who you are. Now, what was implied there is that when the revelation of yourself comes, you will, of course, prove to be more than you expected. That all of that doubting was for no reason, that you were made up of more solid stuff than you even had imagined in your own mind. It could never, of course, mean that you might be horrified at what you find if God was to show you who you really were. That just wouldn't fit with the theology of the day. See, one of our biggest problems as creatures, and this isn't a new problem, it's not solely mitigated to our current culture, but one of our biggest problems is that we reason as creatures according to the standards of fallen humanity. We just kind of all think in the same patterns, and we assume the same sorts of things. I mean, our greatest blindness lies in the fact that we cannot see that God's work is done in the shape of the cross. Always. That God's work is done in the shape of the cross. Always. And because of that, we're unable to see God's goodness in ways that He often chooses to display it. You see, we have come to imagine that God is only going to trade in smaller teddy bears for bigger teddy bears, or that He's going to only prove to us that we were better than we thought we were. And if that is the theology that we have in our mind, of course, you wouldn't say it like that because you're more sophisticated. But a lot of it comes down to the reality that God is in the business of glorifying your life in the way that you feel glory works. And instead, what God gives us in exchange is His cross. And He wants you to see somehow through the lens of the cross a whole new way of viewing life and the world and yourself, and to encourage you to start reinterpreting all that comes to you through that particular cruciform reality. Let us see that this morning in the first section, verses 31 to 34. You'll notice first the confusion of the cross. We have finally come to the point in Luke's gospel where he's bringing up the fact that they're really getting close to Jerusalem. You will remember in chapter 9, verse 51, we began on a journey to the city of Jerusalem, and we are right now at the very last stop. We're going to enter Jericho, and it's the last stop that Christ is making until he enters the holy city. And as they're approaching, Jesus mentions the capital city of Jerusalem and this band of followers who have come behind him, hoping that he is the great Messiah of Israel. And he says, as they approach, everything's about to be fulfilled that the prophets have talked about. Now, can you imagine if you're a disciple that's given up all to follow this one that you hope is the Messiah of Israel? When he says, all the prophecies are about to come true, what comes to mind? I mean, surely the defeat of your enemies, you know, Israel is a great nation once again over all the other. I mean, all those things that God promised that are glorious, and there are a ton of prophecies that promise a wonderful end for the nation of Israel. And Jesus says, here we go, we're coming to Jerusalem, the capital city, I'm the king approaching, and everything is going to be fulfilled. And then he fills in what he means by that with six negatives. He says, I'm going to be delivered over, mocked, shamefully treated, spit upon, flogged, and then I will die. And so he's telling them, we're coming to Jerusalem, and in case you missed it, when we get there, an ordeal is awaiting me. Something that is truly a horror to look at. And it is full, not just of pain, but of shame. Everything about it just reeks of shame and ostracization. And there's only one positive. He says, the third day I will rise. But as he talks about this coming ordeal, there's an obvious lack of understanding. And Luke, just as much as he emphasizes the suffering, wants to emphasize the absolute lack of insight on behalf of the disciples. Their perception is way off, and he can't repeat it any more than he does. He says, they understood none of what he was saying. The saying was hidden from them. They did not grasp what he was saying. I mean, in one sentence, three times, he says the same thing. They don't get what Jesus is preaching in any way, shape, or form, even though this is not the first time he's brought it up. But as they get close, he says, I'm going to suffer. And the disciples say, we don't know what that meant. We will just keep believing what we want to believe is about to happen next. Seeing they do not see. And we see this confusion of categories. Luke, by this double emphasis, shows us where the confusion in his gospel will lie. You can't miss it. He is stressed by piling up descriptions that suffering is coming, and he is also stressed that the disciples do not understand the way of suffering. It makes no sense to them. They cannot do that kind of math. The cross makes absolutely no human sense to the disciples as a means of victory for the Messiah. If Jesus is really the Messiah, if he's the Son of Man, then suffering cannot be in his future. That has to be true in their mind. That's the way that humans think. If he's going to be great, then he needs to be great. If things are going to get better, he needs to have some sort of victory that looks like victory in our eyes. And a crucifixion just doesn't fit the bill. An appropriate destiny for one called by God to be a deliverer is not to be delivered up for death. And the fact is, we can't blame the disciples, can we? I mean, we still have the same confusion. We still have that same struggle. When God delivers certain things into our lives, we cannot see them for what they are. For us, suffering always leads to negatives, and prosperity always leads to positives, no matter how many times history has proven that that is just not the case. I mean, do we ever look for God's remedies in our troubles or His gifts in our worst moments? Or do we cry out immediately for God to deliver us from such things, because bad things are always bad things and what we perceive to be good things are always the good things? Well, if that's the confusion of the cross, you'll notice there's this second encounter, and Luke puts these back to back on purpose, where someone catches a glimpse of the Christ or the true Christ. As we enter the final city before the climax of Luke's story in Jerusalem, we find a man sitting outside of town on the side of the road. He is blind, and in his blindness, he is left destitute. And so he finds himself literally on the fringes of society, hoping for a handout. He's in a terrible position. He hears a ruckus because he can't see anything, and he's curious, so he asks the crowd what's going on. And notice the crowd's insight. Well, they say, it's Jesus of Nazareth, which, I mean, that's a true description, right? But it's the most human way to describe Jesus. Well, there's a lot of Jesuses in town, but this is the Jesus that comes from the town of Nazareth. This is where he grew up. It's speaking completely to his human realities without any spiritual insight at all. But as soon as they say it's Jesus of Nazareth, what does he say? It says he immediately screams out, "Son of David, have mercy on me." You'll notice his insight into the person of Christ far outstrips their insight into who he is. He immediately puts on the messianic title on Jesus. You are the one who we've been waiting for, David's final son. The one who's going to take us into the victory of Israel, the one who's going to be enthroned over the people. You are the one we've been waiting for, and what I want from you is mercy. As he calls out for mercy, you'll notice the crowd rebukes him, tells him, you know, basically, quiet down. We don't got time for this. Which only encourages this guy to shout out all the more. He's not in any way dissuaded by their discouraging words. And when Jesus calls him to himself, he says, "All right, sir, what is it that you want from me?" And again, this amazing spiritual perception. Luke told us a lot of chapters ago, Luke chapter 4, that this one is going to be the servant of the Lord who has the Spirit of the Lord, this Jesus. And one of the things that he will do when he's received the Spirit of the Lord is he will receive or grant sight to the blind. And he uses the term in Luke chapter 4, that's the exact term that this man uses. He says, "What do you want from me?" He says, "Let me recover my sight." What did Luke tell us the Messiah would do, or the one filled with the Spirit? He will bring recovery of sight to the blind. And you'll notice, again, that term recovery is used three times in a row. Luke's trying to link this miracle to what he predicted a long time ago in Luke chapter 4, which is a quote from Isaiah chapter 42 that we read this morning. That the servant of the Lord will grant recovery of sight to the blind. So this blind man somehow knows this is the true messianic son. He's the son of David. And he's the servant of the Lord, the one who's been granted the Spirit of the Lord to give sight to the blind. And he has true spiritual insight into the person of Christ. And so as he asks, so the Lord gives. And as he gives it, notice what the man's response is. He doesn't just glorify God, as wonderful as that is. It says he follows him. He all of a sudden picks up his whole life and says, "I'm going to be in the same train that Jesus is in." And Luke has already told us, he's foreshadowed, where is he following him to? Straight into Jerusalem, that will end at a cross. Which, you know, I can't get into it all this morning, but that is just a very short description of your Christian life. Jesus says, "Follow me," and you say yes as a disciple, and then he says, "Great, you know where we're going? It's a cross." Which, again, undoes a whole lot of modern theology, but it's the clear theology of the Gospels, that the way of discipleship leads us in the way of the cross. And once this man, who was blind, sees, even sees before he can see, and he's granted his sight and he follows Jesus, then his glorying in Christ leads to the same in the crowd. They join in that same magnifying of God through the work of Christ. You'll see this man moves from blindness to sight. But what really happened is this man who had sight, he knew who Jesus was, is given as an illustration of what is lacking currently in the disciples and in the vast majority of the crowd. Luke leaves no doubt in our mind that this is the Messiah, God's anointed Redeemer of Israel. It ends with the whole crowd glorying in God, and he wants to show us by that reality that what Jesus just said before has got to somehow link and jive with what has just happened. This one who just said, I'm about to suffer and be ridiculed and spit upon and crucified, that really is the true Messiah of Israel. So whatever you see, whatever comes next, know that it does not in any way negate that this is really God's Messiah. And that brings us to our final and, in one sense, the main point of this sermon this morning. That the cross is given as a new clarity or new way of vision. To understand Jesus' identity, to understand your faith, to understand who you are, you must understand Christ, and you must understand your life through the lens of the cross. There is no other way to inform your Christianity. I mean, this is the clear point that Luke wants to make for us, and the way that he's arranged this story with the disciples' blindness followed by a blind man serves that end. And you can even see in the language he uses when he tells the disciples, everything that the prophets spoke of is about to be fulfilled. We'll hear words like that again at the end of Luke's gospel. Maybe you'll remember it. Christ has risen from the dead, and there are these two men walking on the road to Emmaus. And they're discouraged by what has taken place. And Jesus comes and asks them, you know, so why the long face? And they're like, I don't know, are you new around here? We had hoped that Jesus was the Messiah. But he was crucified, and all of our hopes because of that have been dashed. It says, while they were talking and discussing these things together, Jesus drew near and he went to them, but their eyes, you'll notice the same language, their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, what is this conversation that you're holding with each other as you walk? And they stood still, looking sad, and one of them, named Cleopas, said, are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have happened there in these days? And Jesus said, what things? Which is just great storytelling altogether. And they said to him, you know, concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and the people, and our chief priests and our rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was to redeem Israel. Notice, they're still blind. Jesus has died and risen, and they are sitting there mourning. And he says, why are you mourning? He says, because Jesus was dead and crucified, and we thought he was going to be the Redeemer of Israel. They still have not linked the cross with the redemption of Israel, even after it has taken place, because their eyes have yet to be opened. And Jesus says to them, oh, you foolish ones, slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. The same language that Luke uses here in our text. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them all the scriptures, the things concerning himself. And then later in verse 30, at the table with them, he took bread and he blessed it and he broke it. What we're going to do here today when we're re-showing forth his death. And what happens once he breaks the bread and his death is shown forth? Their eyes were opened and they recognized their Savior. You see, the cross is more than just an event that took place. It is a revelation. In fact, the revelation, a revelation about God's character, a revelation about the character of God's ways in the world, a revelation about how God views our view of power and preeminence and His view and our view of weakness versus strength. The cross is the supreme revelation of God's mercy. Of that, there is little dispute. But it is also, according to Paul, the supreme revelation of God's power. Okay, and that's where we have a problem. On the cross, Christ defeated sin, the world, and the devil. The cross, this instrument of death, which we view with our naked eye as a sign of sure weakness and defeat, God says, that is where my power is made so obviously manifest, if you have the eyes to see it. So what appears to our naked eyes as weakness and shame really is the power of God and the very glory of God. So if that's true, that does a few things to us. And maybe you don't recognize this all the time. You feel it probably more than you know, but we don't always recognize it. The cross needs to, if we're going to see it rightly, reinterpret how we see God. And because it does this, it must also reinterpret how we see everything else that God does and that He reveals to us. I mean, Luke has tried in small form already to show us this. He's shown us the rich and the righteous and the powerful. And he said, you know, those ones are weak and poor and unholy. And then he has shown us infants and tax collectors and widows. And he says, these ones are powerful and highly prized and righteous. See, we are always in danger, brothers and sisters, of being theologians of glory. And what I mean by that is we look at strength and we say, yes, that's strength. Or we look at the better and say, yes, that's better. Or we look at things and say, bigger is better. We look at blessing and say, blessing must always come by means of addition if it's really going to be blessing at all. We look at power as power and gain as gain and weakness as weakness. But the cross makes us take a new look at all of that. And it forces us to reinterpret how we view the entirety of the world. It forces us to acknowledge that in the worst of things might be hidden the best of things. You understand that the cross does force that upon us. If you look at the cross with just blind and naked sight, it is the putting to death of an innocent, and it is the end of hopes unfulfilled. But if you see it through the interpretation of God, it is the very power of God and salvation for anyone who believes. It is God's greatest act of power that the world has ever known. His defeat somehow is the usurping of all the powers that be. Which means we have no idea how to interpret our own life. Not rightly, not just by bare and naked sight. You see this all the time, don't you? What appears as a blessing at times in life can be turn out to be something that brings horrible outcomes. I mean, as a minister, I've seen this time and time again, you know, the promotion that was so long awaited by somebody becomes for them the beginning of the real downfall of their family. As someone gets more invested in work or their increase leads them further and further away from the Lord, it is not hard to see that certain things that can be blessings or could be blessings can have hidden in them a threat to the undoing of a soul. But how often the opposite is true as well. The thing that we so much dreaded, those fears that we've always, you know, tried to run from in our life, well, when those things, you know, show up at our doorstep, whether they be, you know, cancer or rebellion or addiction or poverty, we say, you know, this is the thing I want to avoid. And in and of themselves, they are negatives. But of course, if we're looking at the world through the lens of the cross, we have no idea what is hidden in those things. How is it that sometimes the tragic things, the worst of things, can become the things that draw us so much nearer to Christ and become for us the greatest blessings in our lives, if we can only see them for what they are? Remember, there was a moment in our own life where we had gone to a doctor's appointment for one of our children that was still in the womb. And during the ultrasound, there was some concerns, and the doctor showed us on a close-up that there were some things going on in the brain that she was concerned about. And she said, you know, there's a pretty good chance this child is going to have Down syndrome. And I remember us going home that day and just the weight of it all. Like, what does that mean for us? What will that mean for raising of our other children? And what will that mean for, you know, just how much more difficult life is about to become? And so I remember I went online and I just started looking up, you know, okay, what's it like to live with a child with Down syndrome? And after about the fifth article, I just remember thinking, like, this is the strangest thing I've ever encountered. Every single article began with how hard that this news was when it hit the family, and how every family said, this child has been the greatest blessing to every person in the entirety of our household. And these weren't even just Christian articles. These were just articles written by parents of children who had Down syndrome. That hidden within something, of course, that to us looks like it could only be a negative, God sometimes does His most beautiful work. And how is that? Because as we know, God does work in mysterious ways, or as Luther says, God always works under the opposite. And why this is so important, especially in a time like ours, that we live in a culture that says things like, in their, you know, bite-sized theology, God wants you happy. And of course, what we mean when we hear those words is happiness is achieved by doing things that make you happy. And of course, we're the best judge of that. But if you look at the cross, can you really look at the cross and say, okay, if the cross is the number one definer of my Christian life, it's the thing that defines God's character to me, as well as the shape and character of the Christian existence. Can you say, above all else, God wants me happy? If the cross really is the defining reality of our faith, might it also speak to us that we don't even know what our happiness would look like? Because in that cross, we truly are made utterly joyful. That cross will bring about and usher forth all our blessedness from here to eternity. But again, to the naked eye, it appears as only tragedy. See, God does some of His best work in our worst circumstances. Some of the things that we would not wish to endure again have been for us the greatest gain for our spiritual existence. And when we were praying for God to bless us, that was not what we intended in the prayer. We intended prosperity and enlargement, and oftentimes God brought those blessings through what seemed to be a ravaging of our hopes and dreams. But it brought to us a clinging to an eternal God who is always good to His people. So if we're to look at what I encountered under my search on hashtags, and we were to read, "Trust me, I have something better for you," as Jesus hides a bigger teddy bear, I think we can read that and say, sure, that is true. But of course, the biblical promise of something better may not come true until the resurrection and renewing of all things. And the better is defined by Christ and His cross, not by our own measures and judgments. Maybe the better will be in giving you less, and the less will make Him so much more, and your contentment so much greater. Or the other one, imagine doubting yourself and then boom, God shows you who you are. Can you imagine it? The part where God shows you who you are. And every now and then, in His mercy, He does show us who we are. And rarely is it a bastion of strength or us thinking, who would have known I had so much good in there? Instead, sometimes He pulls back the curtain and says, that's who you are. You can look at it in the eye. And of course, when He shows us what that is and how bad it is and how far from His glory it is, the upside of that is that it makes the cross all the more beautiful to the one who needs it. Whereas in our strength, if He was to reveal to us, well, you're better than you ever thought, the cross will only shrink in your estimation. It will never grow larger. But God in His mercy does let us see who we are. Thankfully, not all the time. And as He does, again, it's to the cross that we run. And that indeed is a blessing, just not the one that we would have expected. I say all of that as we close, that you might keep this in mind. In a time like our own, it is of the utmost importance to hold to these truths. You, dear brothers and sisters, no matter how much research you've done, have no idea what is going to happen. You have no idea what's going to happen in the elections. You have no idea what's happening with this pandemic. You have no idea what will happen with the Supreme Court or any other potential conspiracy that lies, at the gates of the city. And furthermore, what you see with your eyes is not what is. What you think would be the greatest blessing could have hidden within it a great curse. What you perceive to be the worst thing, the bad thing, the thing that would be your undoing or our nation's undoing or your family's undoing, the cross testifies to us that you have absolutely no way of telling. Not by human sight. But that cross does tell us this. That the God of the cross is far more loving and giving and merciful than you could ever imagine. And that His wisdom is so all-encompassing, so far higher than our own wisdom, that out of the worst of things, in fact, the worst thing, the cross, has come the best thing that you have in your life. And therefore, stop judging your world by feeble sense. Stop thinking that in your own wisdom, apart from the cross, you know exactly what's coming down the pipe. The cross testifies to you as a child of God that you need not fear. That thing that to you would be your utter undoing might undo you in the best way possible. In fact, the Bible promises you that all things, even the bad things, are working together for your good. Since you love Him and you're called according to His purpose. So as we go forward from this place, as we consider things like lifting high the cross, may you have in your own vision of the world the reality that the God of the cross controls the end from the beginning. And while you may not understand why He does what He does, and you may be concerned about what the future may hold, that same cross that causes confusion because of our own way of viewing the world is also our comfort in the midst of chaos. That God is doing a good work and He's bringing about the salvation of His people that He promised, just like the prophets foretold.